Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, let's have a look at this great wonder.
Here we are. That's my timeship.
Oh, so that's it, eh? This horrible block of stone.
Precisely.
How does one exactly get into hammer and chisel?
Pull to open.
Yes, and what do you do?
Gullible peasants who believe everything I say to them.
Mr. Taylor! Where are you with that string, dear boy?
Come along.
Now, vibrations. Ticklish. Get back.
Here come the drums! Come the drums.
Hello and welcome to Pull to Open, an ongoing quest to watch all of Doctor Who, the entire television program, in random order. I'm Pete Paschal.
And I'm Chris Taylor, and we have a very, very special episode of Pull to Open for you. This is not our first time on location, but it is our first time with some actual locations.
Close
to the location of our story, which is very exciting. Let's get straight into it. Pete, tell the good folks at home how we have been traveling through this random adventure and perhaps some salient points for recent adventures that we've been to.
Happy to. Previously on Pull to Open. In the recent past, everyone, we were in the Peter Capaldi era, had a little adventure, bigger on the inside, more than ever before, called Flatline.
That's right, with
fun,
a tiny,
action.
Teeny tiny TARDIS.
Mm-hmm. Lots of hands carrying the TARDIS, coming out of the TARDIS. It was good times. Speaking of hands of Time Lords, that had artifacts named after their hand, of a Time Lord that tried to transfer from an antimatter universe who may have had that hand figuratively, we were at Arc of Infinity.
That's wow. We got there in the end. That line became an arc. The arc of that link was long, but it bent towards justice.
That was the bendiest segue I think I've ever done on this show. You're welcome, Pull to Open listeners. Arc of Infinity, yes. We were there at the beginning of season 20, which will soon be out on Blu-ray, by the way, in a special package with a whole bunch of new special features. You're welcome, BBC.
That's right. The randomizer brought to you by the BBC Enterprises.
But once we picked up Tegan, we went right back in our TARDIS and rewound to before her era, just a few stories before her era, though. It was full circle, the beginning of the T-Space trilogy.
The line became an arc, became a circle. And if that wasn't enough to allow you to understand and realize the awesome power of the randomizer, it then took us to where we needed to go once again.
You know, I just got that line arc circle thing. Wow.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
We've
been in the hands of big trigonometry, big geometry.
But we have been taken by big geometry all the way back into season 2, serial 9, The Time Meddler.
That's right. One that I hadn't seen. And was eager to see. Pete, you have seen this one before?
Yeah, a few times. So going even further back than the recent stories I just mentioned, we have visited season two a couple of times here on the podcast. But most notably, we've done the beginning of season two, which was Planet of Giants, one of the only three episoders in the classic run.
Right.
And it's interesting to sort of think about that season and starting with the TARDIS team of Ian, Barbara, and Susan, and here we're ending it with a completely different TARDIS team of Vicky and Steven.
We are, but we're also starting it with a tiny TARDIS of Planet of Giants,
right,
and ending it, spoiler alert, with a tiny TARDIS.
So to speak.
Not necessarily.
Different
TARDIS, but yeah, we will get there. But wow, what a connection. That randomizer's throwing up so many connections. We're coming up with new ones on the fly. But yes, we have gone from the beginning to the end of season two, from tiny TARDIS to tiny TARDIS, from TARDIS team to TARDIS team. This is the first story without the original TARDIS team, right? The first story post Ian and Barbara.
Yes, with no one from that original companion team. Yes. Obviously, the Doctor's the same, but you know, Vicky had come on board on another story we had done
with the rescue,
and we actually already did the Romans as well. Mm-hmm. So we've definitely had some Vicky adventures, and this particular era is interesting because this story begins a lot of things with Doctor Who, even though it ends season two, and we'll get to all of that. But before we get to that, I just want to remind everyone, if you want to cut straight to our commentary on the Time Meddler, you have the ability to do that. You can go into the notes on the podcast that you are listening to find the exact time code where we begin that commentary, or just scroll down if you're on YouTube. Go ahead. That same time code's there. You can fast forward right to that point if you so choose, but you're not going to want to do that, guys, because why would you? Because you're going to miss the Humoji challenge. We've got a brand new brain teaser for none other than Chris Taylor, our new contestant on the Humoji challenge. We also have a comment of the week from one of our YouTube viewers, and we have some results from Arc of Infinity, the controversially rated Arc of Infinity here on Pull to Open. So stick around for all that as we enter the Pull to Open pulse loop.
Nice. All right.
Now, the correct response is fetch a Thalia.
I'll learn that one eventually. But in the meantime, listeners, one of the best ways to support Pull to Open and show that you support Pull to Open is to buy our merch. No, it is to leave a review in the podcast.
Spoiler alert.
Merch TK. Yeah, we got the merch back. It's too tiny. They had the dimensional control taken out of it. But instead, you can leave us a review in the podcast app, the very podcast app that you are using right now. You can do it while you're listening to us, especially if it's Apple Podcasts. That's nice. 5-star reviews, also nice if you feel that way. That'll make the show visible to more listeners and listenable to more viewers. Something like that.
Yeah, it will.
No, that works.
Multitasking. The polarity of that all the time.
Exactly. And the only better way to show your appreciation for the show is to share it with a random friend. That's right. Use random.org, as we do every week, to randomize your own friends. Choose someone in your contacts, spin the wheel, send them this link, and continue the joys of randomness by sending this podcast around, and then your friends too will get to witness me being the Ken Jennings of the Humoji challenge, which is what's about to happen.
Jennings when he was a contestant, though, not a host. So let's be clear about that, because yes, guys, it is now time for the Humoji challenge.
Oh boy.
And this is the time in the show, of course, where I get to give Chris his greatest pleasure during a podcast recording. And we're going to have a title, a Doctor Who story title in the form of an emoji submitted by one of our loyal listeners. And he is going to guess that story. Are you ready, sir?
As I will ever be. I've not looked through the codex recently, so I'm entirely going on my memory of Doctor Who episode titles, story titles. So let's do this.
Let's do this. Okay. I think you're gonna got. I think you got this one.
Okay.
Let me see.
Usually you say that. I don't get it so much.
So we got two emojis.
Oh boy. Okay.
First emoji. The brain.
Uh-huh.
Second emoji. The infinity sign in a circle. So there's a circle around sort of the infinity, you know, it's like a sideways eight, if you know what I mean.
So it's not Brain of Morbius?
It is Brain of Morbius!
Morbius, because Mobius loop. Okay, I get it.
Mobius, Morbius. It's only a consonant away. It's acceptable. Did I give it away by using a definite article in front of brain? I said the brain. And you could go right to what article, what story starts with the brain?
I mean, I guess it could have been the mind of evil if the second emoji had been something representing a devil. Well, there's a tip for you.
Boom.
I know.
There you go.
For extra credit.
From listener Chris Taylor.
You know what? Throw that up against me next week. I will have forgotten that I said it, and I could probably defeat myself on that one.
Right. Probably because of some brain surgery, perhaps. Awesome. You too can submit a emoji title for the emoji challenge anytime. That one, of course, came from Bob Gilby, who submitted a bunch on Twitter. Thank you, Bob. Loyal listener, friend of the pod. But you can do that too. Go ahead, give us a shout at Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all of which we're at Pull2Open63. You can leave a comment on TikTok where we're at Pull2Open, all one word. Or go ahead and just leave one on a YouTube comment. We're at youtube.com/Pull2Open. All good places to submit your Doctor Who story title in the form of emoji. And we would love to keep this challenge going.
Yeah, and you can't submit your emoji challenge on Spotify, but what you can do on Spotify is take part in our poll and in a feature we call Poll to Open, where we leave the polls open on all of our stories. So if you think that you just may have heard us talking about Ark of Infinity, for example, and you may have opinions about Ark of Infinity, just go to that episode, vote in the poll. You don't even need to listen to it. Add your vote right now. And we do have some results from Ark of Infinity, and it's a surprise. Because if you recall, if you listened to that episode, I rated Ark of Infinity an Ogron. It's a bad episode, bad story with no redeeming features. He'd rated it a Professor Hater, appropriately enough, given it's right after Time Flight, which is, you know, a bad story, but at least we learned something. At least it
showed, they tried something.
At least they tried something new. We like to reward that. Well, this is I did not expect this, but our audience seems to love Ark of Infinity. A full 14% gave it a Viscount Banger, our top rating. 43% gave it a Dalek, our good rating, our basically good episode. So that is a clear majority there for Ark of Infinity being worth your time. Were you as surprised by that result as I was, Bean?
No, because given my familiarity with Doctor Who memes, I think Gun-Toting Nyssa is such a popular one that the people were showing some reverence for the source of that meme. Also, I do think the reasons I gave it a hater and didn't, you know, even though it's a troubled story, are pretty evident. I think most people remember Ark of Infinity not just for Nyssa shooting a bunch of people, but the nice showdown at the end between Davison and Davison, as well as Commander Maxwell, who,
right, aka Colin Baker.
Colin Baker steals the show every chance he gets. So, you know, there's a lot to like about Ark of Infinity, and I can see if you focus on those elements, you come away wanting more and wanting to see it again.
Yeah. Only 29% agreed with you, Pete, that it was a Professor Hater, but that's more than agreed with me that it was an Ogron. Only 14% Ogrons, no fixed point in time votes, no Lady Cassandra votes for It's Pretty But Has a Paper Thin Plot. Wow, we may have more classic show fans than I knew among our audience, but do keep voting on those Spotify polls.
Do keep voting. Also, do keep visiting our YouTube page. It's getting more and more followers every day. Thank you for that. If you actually listen on a podcast app, but don't follow us on YouTube, please go ahead and do that. That really does help the show if you subscribe to our channel. And hey, if you that's the primary way you find our content, don't forget to go ahead and hit that bell icon. That'll let you know we have new content. And, you know, keep on visiting the page and commenting. So we have some great comments on YouTube. Our YouTube commenters, I got to say, do a great job giving good YouTube commenters a good reputation. And one of the regular contributors is Ethan Melton, and he had a great comment of the week that I'd like to read right now. And this is on one of our recent sort of side trips that I haven't mentioned, but the side trip where we talked about who is the best actor to play the role of the Doctor. And we had our favorites. We definitely asked for folks to talk about theirs. And they delivered, but I loved Ethan's support here. He says, I'm glad you guys put Troughton on your list.
Right.
My favorite. He's great not only at doing completely opposite emotional states, but making it feel natural when he transitions between them. Amen.
Indeed.
Also, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that you left off Michael Jaston from your list, who played the Valyard. How did we miss Michael Jaston?
Well, the Valyard is not, you know, I mean, we're going to have to redefine like what it is to play the Doctor on screen. Like the Valyard is just sort of a shade, right? He's between the Doctor's 12th and final regenerations, I think is what is officially canon about him. If we're going to do the Valyard, we got to do the actor who played the Watcher, even though he didn't have any dialogue.
Right.
So, and then you sort of start to get into that, you know, echoes of echoes. But no, that's a fair point. He's a good actor. Kind of a bit one note as the Valyard, though, I have to say. There's not really much dimensionality to his performance.
So on the is he or isn't he, I think it's a conversation worth having, but I think it's totally valid to have the end of that conversation be, no, he's not on the list for sort of the reasons you stated. And he's kind of the Doctor, but he's not playing the Doctor as we know the role, or even as the show Bible would describe the role, right? It's more of a mislead and a unmasking and a plot twist than characterization. So I think it's totally fine to draw a line where the Valyard's on the other side of it. That said, I like Michael Jaston. I like some of those court scenes. It produces some of the better dialogue of the whole trial. I definitely wouldn't mind them revisiting the Valyard if someone has sort of an interesting thing to say about it or an interesting take from a plot standpoint on how that character could be reintroduced. But I'm certainly not mandating that or dying to see that happen. I think there are other ways to explore the Doctor's darker nature that are more interesting. And I think the show's already kind of done that in many ways with the Time War stuff. So,
indeed.
Yeah.
But, stay tuned for our pull to open short trip, The Validity of the Valyard. Sounds like a good title. But also, what sounds good is you following us on YouTube, because, by the way, we're going to have a little bit of footage a little later on. So that's why you're going to want to go to YouTube. If you're just listening to this, that's fine. But you're actually going to see the setting of the Time Meddler, or the only possible setting for the Time Meddler. We'll get into that, but that might be one reason that you want to transfer right now and start watching this podcast as well as just listening to it. So go ahead and smash that bell icon.
That's right. We'll still be here, and you get to see my William Hartnell poster, folks. Hey. I never had this up. It's right there. Yes, it's the one from Doctor Who magazine. Yes, it's technically the Dalek invasion of Earth, but you know what? It's Hartnell.
Close enough.
And yeah, we need to celebrate.
Yeah.
But before we even get to that footage, I almost called it found footage. We found it on your iPhone.
Yeah.
Before we get to the footage, we have to get a little task out of the way, everyone. And that task, of course, is TLDW, Too Long, Didn't Watch, Too Long, Doctor Who, where one of us summarizes the entire story of the story we're about to talk about in record time.
Yeah.
Today, the person is Chris Taylor. Oh, dude. I always feel for you because you got the emoji challenge and now you got the TLDW, and it's like, do you have the energy?
I feel like this is a pretty easy one. It's a pretty simple story, although, you know, famous last words in TLDW. But still, like I felt for you last week or last time when we did Full Circle, the last TLDW we did. There was a lot going on there to unpack. And this, not so much. Like, you know, on the surface, simple story. A lot of stuff going on under the surface and behind the story. But I think the problem then becomes that you get drawn into rabbit holes of like,
yeah,
you know.
I think this one story-wise is structurally, but because of it's sort of a slow reveal, there's probably some time jumping you're going to have to kind of do to get it properly explained fully. And it, through those time jumps, you could get dragged into the vortex. So really? Avoid yeah. that. Mm. But if you want to go on holiday for the second episode, I totally get it.
Yes, William Hartnell, famously not in the second episode. So in honor of William Hartnell, I will leave the room for 30 seconds. No, I will still be here. I will use that time. We allot 30 seconds per classic episode. There are four episodes in the Time Meddler. And yes, that gives me 2 minutes. Pete will do the timing. I'm flying blind. I'm not looking at notes. I'm just remembering everything that we saw in this story. So
this story, which of course is the Time Meddler, and here comes the poll to open summary of that story in 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay, so the Vicky and Doctor and the TARDIS, they've just let Ian and Barbara go, and Vicky, the Doctor wants to know if Vicky wants to be dropped off as well. But before they can really get into that, there's a noise, and it's they think it's a Dalek from the Chase is in the TARDIS, but no, it's Stephen Taylor from the Chase, and they land in 11th century Britain. Stephen doesn't necessarily believe it. The Doctor finds a space helmet for a cow and says it's a Viking helmet, and then they wander up, and a monk is watching them, and the Doctor goes into this village and drinks some mead with a woman named Edith, and then says he's going to go up to the monastery because things are a bit weird around here. Stephen and Vicky find a modern watch, which Stephen uses as evidence that they haven't actually traveled in time. And this isn't the 11th century. The Doctor gets trapped by a monk who traps him in a cell, and then Stephen and Vicky go after him, but the monk gives himself away by saying what the Doctor's description was, and so they know he's in there. And meanwhile, there are these Saxons, and there's a raiding party of Vikings, and they attack the village, and the Doctor knows that the Vikings are going to come and distract the King Harald, and that's why King Harald's going to lose the Battle of Hastings, and that the monk wants to change it. He wants to change history, and he's got all these anachronous things, and he's got some neutron rockets that he's going to fire at the Viking fleet, and then so that he can change history, so that history will advance more quickly. But the Doctor manages to shut him down by taking the dimensional control out of the monk's TARDIS, and the monk's TARDIS goes tiny. And meanwhile, Stephen, the Vicky, and the Doctor go back to the TARDIS. The Vikings have been defeated by the villagers, and everything's okay. And we see them against a starfield at the end. Supposedly to show us that there are more adventures of the Doctor, Stephen, and Vicky. And that's about it. The monk may be returning to your screen soon. Cool. All right. Yes. So I kind of left out a lot of shenanigans with the villagers and the Vikings, right?
Yeah, there was definitely like some forgettable stuff that's a bit back and forthy in the second and third episode, sort of necessitated a bit by Hartnell not being there. But yeah, good summary. So you did it in about a minute 55 or so.
Yeah.
Including the starfield.
I know, right? I mean, that is so I was not aware of how this story ends, right? I had never seen it before. And first of all, I have to ding BritBox for choosing as its the image that you get for episode 4, the monk looking into his tidy TARDIS.
Oh, giveaway.
Right?
Yeah.
But it is...
I actually have the season 2 Blu-rays.
Ah,
so
okay. A better way.
Did not have that giveaway. I knew that was going to happen, but I was glad I didn't have that because I was watching with my kids who hadn't seen it before.
Yeah.
And I got to say that cliffhanger at the end of episode 3 definitely had them sit up and pay attention, even though they were enjoying it. I got to say that this is one of the more accessible stories of the era because, you know, and that's really just going, I know that's sort of what it's reputed to do, but the proof's in the pudding. My kids were into it kind of the whole time. But when that reveal happens, when it's like, they were both like, whoa, this guy's a Time Lord? You know, it's just like, cool, which is, of course, what you say in 2023 when you see that it's a TARDIS.
Yep.
But it is interesting to note that that reveal still holds up with people who haven't seen the show
before. Yes, and it held up with me. And then also, so the Starfield, I just thought it's worth throwing into the summary because it also surprised me. Like, wow, this is different. It's a very groovy mid-60s thing.
It's almost, you almost think the best of the Hartnell era is yet to come.
Yes. except it isn't.
Yeah. There's
the gunfight.
They put on a good show.
Interview.
Yeah. Because the infamous behind the scenes stuff here is Verity Lambert was already on her way out at this point. Mm-hmm. She commissioned the story, so she's listed as producer. I don't know how involved she was, but John Wiles, who had serious issues with the whole cast, particularly Hartnell, was just coming in. I understand those issues began here where, you know, he was just essentially getting his fingers in the story a little bit. And Hartnell didn't like the calls he was making. So they kind of got off on a rough foot. And then, you know, we've talked about this in our commentary on the Celestial Toymaker and the Smugglers a little bit on the issues in season 3.
Yeah.
Luckily, at this point, they're not yet on screen so much, unless you count Hartnell kind of not being there for an episode, which unfortunately I would say does weaken this story a little bit.
Yeah, that's a little unfortunate. But yeah, let's zero back to the big reveal of the monk, because that is, you know, that's the headline from this story. And I was surprised as a Doctor Who fan who knows a lot about the show but hadn't seen this story, I was surprised how clearly it is described that he is one of the Doctor's people, which is both more precise than I thought it would be and leaves open a lot of possibilities. Because the interesting thing about this story chronologically is it went out, I believe, at the same time as Doctor Who and the Daleks starring Peter Cushing hit theaters.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So there were, you know, we're in the midst of Dalek mania here. Yeah. But of course,
to just locate in space and time, that'd be like July 1965.
Right. So it's around about this time. And you could have gone to see it and then watch this on TV. So it would have been an interesting place to go. But of course, in that movie, the Doctor's described, basically portrayed as an inventor,
right,
from a different time, but pretty much human, right? If I remember that movie correctly, like it's, you basically get
the sense, I mean, if it's not said, it's strongly implied. Now, I would say that what's revealed here in the Time Meddler doesn't necessarily contradict that.
Right.
Obviously, it does go on to be contradicted in the War Games, which we've done. Mm-hmm. So there is more than you remember revealed here, but still surprisingly little. So one of the things the Doctor mentions is that, yes, they're from the same people in the same place, but that the monk is from about 50 years later.
He says it in a weird way that doesn't like necessarily chronologically locate him 50, something like 50 years after. Or 50 years on. I don't remember how he said it, but it's confusing.
It sounds a bit like he's judging based on the time machine. He is an upgraded version of his time machine that I don't know how the Doctor would know when it's from since he left 50 years prior to this.
Right.
But maybe he's got a little bit of intel. And also, like, there's the whole thing about Gallifrey and, you know, people who are from a certain time on Gallifrey tend to come back to that time. There seems to be some sort of time alignment happening there. So it's not like you could go back to Gallifrey's past easily if you're a Time Lord, even though they've done that a bit, I think, in the sort of novels and big finishes. So I think the Doctor's also judging by he's been away for 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, something like that.
That could make sense. We can get the transcript, pull it up, and see exactly what he says. But yeah, so the monk's TARDIS is a Mark IV, and it's a Mark IV of a Type 40. It gets a little bit confusing because you're sort of smushing together the terminology of different eras here. But that's basically it looks like the Doctor's TARDIS, which is the exciting thing.
He asks the Doctor, what type's yours? And the Doctor says, none of your business, which is a funny line. I mean, this is one of the things about the Time Meddler. There's really great bits of comedy here. Mm-hmm. And I would say really great casting of Peter Purvis, who is very capable of those sort of comedic scenes and playing off of Maureen O'Brien.
Yes.
But back to the sort of Mark IV versus Type 40. So I forget, honestly, when the Type 40 is first revealed. I think it might be as late as the Tom Baker era.
Mm.
But the idea, like, to reconcile these things, it could be one of two things. It could be what you suggested, which is that they're both... his isn't a Mark IV. The Doctor's isn't a Mark IV. So is it a Mark III and there are like 1 to 50 and his is a 40? Or is it the other way where they're both Type 40s, Mark 1, 2, 3, 4, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Do they name things like Apple where it's literally every one thing gets a number, or is it more like Bose where you skip over numbers? So you have Quiet Comfort 1, 2, then 20 or whatever they did, right? So maybe there's only 5 versions of TARDIS.
Oh my goodness.
40 means 4, but it's also like you could do little, you know, 41, 42, 43 if you had sort of subversions.
Now I really want a Gallifrey episode where we see the Gallifreyan equivalent of Steve Jobs. Basically doing a keynote live on stage where he unveils the latest TARDIS.
Here's the TARDIS Nano.
With dimensional control removed. Yes, exactly. With no dimensional control. I love it. Okay. So by the way, what it says in the show is literally it. So the Doctor says, you know, the monk says, what type's yours, Doctor? The Doctor says, mind your own business. Stephen says, look, I take it you both come from the same place, Doctor. And the Doctor says, yes, I regret that we do, but I would say that I am 50 years earlier.
Right. So he's kind of estimating.
Right.
And the Doctor's experienced. I would sort of put a lot of stock in that estimation. So what this also does, though, whether he's right or wrong, I think it more or less confirms the monk is not the master.
Yes. That's so clear, because my first sort of judgment on the monk after watching the show was like, what if the master, but crap? but just doesn't really have a good, I mean, he's got a sort of big comedy list, right? Of
that one list thing I didn't is mention. Epic. Oh my god, that's giant, speaking of memes.
He's got this giant to-do list. Is it a meme? Because it needs to be. It's like the largest checklist you've ever seen on like a, you know, huge A2 poster.
Well, it's literally like those easels they would have in elementary school classrooms where the teacher is teaching writing and like every line has a dotted line in the middle. So you're learning that the small letters go to the dotted line and the big letters go to the top line. And it's written out in this beautiful third grade teacher font.
Yeah.
And it's just the funniest like things on it. Like, I mean, it's like meet King Harold is the last one.
He's
right?
The last one. And it's supposed to be his whole scheme is like to use King Harold to like, get an earlier renaissance, basically to bring about a flowering of technology.
I like that. That's the last thing. Cause it's more like, no, he doesn't really care about the tech stuff. He just wants a selfie with King Harold. Right? Like,
that's really what the last to do should say.
He's a history celebrity fanboy.
Yeah. But you'd think you'd want to meet him first if you're going to use him as your sort of, you know, because the monk does say, look, you know, I want to get like jet engines by the 14th century. I want Shakespeare to be able to put Hamlet on TV and watch it on TV, you know, in his own century.
Well, we're kind of getting into if the evil plot had succeeded here in that territory. But yes, he does note all that stuff. He does seem to... he describes his plan as like, this is his master plan, which again, I think some people latch on and think, is that the master? It's like, no, you can have master plans without the master. Obviously the Daleks had one. But it's like, it's kind of a silly master plan. And he gets really excited about these technological advances. So you definitely get the impression he hasn't done something this big in terms of altering history, because his diary is filled with stuff like he deposited some money somewhere and took it out 200 years later and was a millionaire.
Right, which is a joke, by the way, that Douglas Adams repeats in The Hitchhiker's Guide. And now we see where he got it from.
Yeah, and it's also kind of like the most obvious thing you could do. Like, it's like right in there. I mean, you know, again, it's 1965, so, you know, this is what became cliche is pretty new. But he also mentions that he gave Leonardo da Vinci the idea of powered flight.
Which isn't exactly time meddling, right? Because da Vinci did have the idea of powered flight.
Yes, but it's like, I like... This is a good segue to sort of back into the conversation about changing history, right? Because that's one of the big sort of markers here in Doctor Who, where this episode seems to explicitly contradict the Aztecs. So in the Aztecs in the previous season one, Barbara tries to alter history by making the Aztecs less barbaric, tries to get them to stop their human sacrifice or at least reconsider it. Essentially, they push back. But the Doctor articulates it in a sense of like, this is time pushing back. Yeah. Like, you can't change history. Not one line is a famous line from that serial. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But now, like, this seems to say the opposite. And it seems very clear from, now, again, Vicky's speculating a bit here, so I don't know if we can take it as 100% definitive. But she does talk about how, like, well, if the monk changes history, the history books will change because they haven't been written yet. Their memories of it will probably change. That's unclear, actually. I don't know if that would happen because they are now time travelers. And it seems like rules are different for time travelers.
Yeah, they do express it as a concern for history books more than anything else. It's like, oh no, the history books will change. Like, not that history itself. But
this seems to be the earliest point where Doctor Who comes out and says time can be rewritten. Mm. And the Doctor's warnings, to reconcile that with the Aztecs, the Doctor's warnings there are more figurative. I think you could sort of back read it as he's not literally saying time will try to stop you. Or even if it does, you can potentially change history, but you really, really, really shouldn't. Mm. You know, that's kind of, I think, how to back read the Aztecs a bit with those so-called time can be rewritten laws of time.
Did you notice, by the way, that the Doctor, Vicky, and Stephen all seem to have a remarkable amount of British history knowledge, considering that, you know, both Vicky and Stephen are from the future. The Doctor really seems to have studied his British history, you know, and there's that whole aside that was apparently ad-libbed by William Hartnell, where he sort of explains the history of William the Conqueror.
I was curious about that. You were a British schoolboy once. Did you learn all about William the Conqueror and the Norman invasion and the Vikings and all the background of that? Is that just pretty common in
Britain? It is pretty common in Britain. And it was certainly pretty common at the time. There was a famous sort of comedy book that the kids latched onto at the time called 1066 and all that. Which is kind of a parody of the British history that everyone was taught. But yeah, you know, everyone knew that 1066 was huge. It was coming up. The 900th anniversary was coming up when this came out.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So that's why they focus on 1066. But yeah, it is
true. Wow, the 100th anniversary is coming up, I'm just realizing, in a few decades.
In a few decades, that's right. We will revisit, I'm sure, 1066 in 2066. Look out for the Time Meddler 2, or the Time Meddler 3, I guess, since the monk returned and the Dalek invasion of Earth. It's kind of interesting that he just it is masterish in the sense that, if you remember, lo, those many years ago, right back at the beginning of our random journey, we did the King's Demons, where the Master's evil plan is to prevent the Magna Carta from being signed.
derided as low stakes, even by his standards, by the Doctor himself. So,
and
think of that what you will.
Wouldn't really, as we discussed in the History Corner then, wouldn't even have had that much of an effect on history had it not been signed.
Was it time, Chris? Shall we?
To get in the History Corner? Well,
shall we enter?
Sure.
Roll to open History Corner. That's, with historian Chris Taylor.
That's so exciting that we now have a sting for the History Corner. But it's also so exciting that we have a History Corner this week because, okay, background to this. So I am originally from the northeast of England. That's where I grew up. And that's where I've visited once before when we recorded the show while I was in the UK, while I was visiting family here for The Mark of the Rani, which is also set in the northeast of England. So the randomizer knows when I am going on vacation home to my family here, and it throws up a northeastern story. Now, Mark of the Rani is very clearly a northeastern story because it has George Stephenson, you know, local legend, inventor of the first steam engine. But this one's a bit more subtle because it's set in Northumbria, which is basically a northern kingdom that was a kingdom before it was absorbed by the Kingdom of England. And it extended all the way from the Scottish border down to the Humber, where York is. They're basically, you know, so the Vikings did, as it says in the Time Meddler, the Vikings basically came down the coast. They sailed up the Humber, and King Harold, who had succeeded Edward the Confessor, went and met them at a place called Stamford Bridge, now famous as Chelsea Football Club's home ground. It's also called Stamford Bridge, but different Stamford Bridge. And it was because he was so exhausted after that battle that he did not have the forces or the energy or, you know, what have you, to defeat William, the William the Bastard, as he was known before he became William the Conqueror. Who, you know, basically took over all of England, took over all of the English territories. Now, Doctor Who magazine, some years ago, looked into this because the question is, where is the Time Meddler set? So obviously it's got to be north, somewhere north in Northumbria of the Humber, where the Battle of Stamford Bridge took place, where King Harold defeated the Vikings. Right. There's basically only one option that was existent at the time. And here it is. You can see I've got the guidebook because I literally just went there. Tynemouth Priory, which we know existed in 1065. And I've visited. I've got some footage of the site that you can hopefully see. It is fascinating, not only because we have evidence that it existed in 1065 because they found the bones of a saint there. I don't know if that was meddling monks doing.
Do they know which one?
Saint Oswin. If you can believe, cool. Right?
Wow, I think we might be answering another one of our questions, but we'll get to that later.
Right, so that's interesting from a Doctor Who perspective. But yeah, this is basically, so we know it's sort of a priory on a hill. You know, it's the monk chooses it because it's the perfect place to launch atomic weapons at the Viking fleet, which seems a bit a bit too much.
And to get the gullible villagers doing his every whim.
Yeah, to get them to light flames that would lure the Vikings ashore and, you know, what have you. But basically, it's Tynemouth. And it's a fascinating place to visit. I highly recommend it if you're visiting the northeast of England ever. Not least because you do get that sense of this time is out of joint because, you know, the monk has his big guns on the hillside in the story. By the way, the Time Meddler really does kind of defeat the rule of, you know, Chekhov's rule about if you see the gun, then it has to go off. We don't get the gun being fired. However, there are guns there because it was such a strategic encampment that you had cannons there. You know, you had Henry VIII trying to fortify it when he was worried about France and Spain invading. You had cannons in the Napoleonic era, and you had the really big guns in World War II in case the Germans were going to land, and they are still there. So you go and you see all these gravestones in this sort of spooky area, including one area that still kind of looks like the prison that the Doctor was thrown in. A lot of sarcophagi that kind of looked like the tomb that was the monk's TARDIS.
Did you check them on the base for yep. any doors?
Yep,
any cables flying out of there?
Clicking, trying to click and see. But no joy. But yeah, and these big guns. So it's very strange. I highly recommend going to visit Tynemouth Priory and then walking down the hill to a little place, a little fish and chip shop just down the hill, where they are very excited to tell you that Jimi Hendrix once had fish and chips there. And have that sign.
Well, it's nice to know the villagers are still really gullible.
Yes, I looked to see if Edith's Mead was still on sale, but no.
Edith's Mead, that needs to be on a cocktail menu of Doctor Who drinks, because this is one of the few times that we do see the Doctor drink. Well, anyway, yeah. First of all, thanks for the rundown on the location. That's really interesting. I'm glad the cannons on the cliff face checks out. It does seem like you would want to do that at various places in England.
Absolutely. By the way, I should give a shout out to our good friends at the Cloister Bell podcast, Rob and Liam, who are also based here in the Northeast and turned me on to this knowledge that the Tynemouth Priory has that connection. So we're kind of lacking connections to Doctor Who up here in the frozen North.
Yeah, we got to reconnect with those guys at some point, whether we're in England or not. But yeah, so the Mead scene is interesting because we talked about it before. And because of it, is the Doctor an alcoholic? We talked about in our Gunfighters podcast, and we showed this as sort of proof that he might be.
Yes.
But it's interesting. The one part I didn't watch or I forgot about when we were talking about that is he tosses the mead the second time. So he has a drink and he talks about how it's very nice and delicious. And it seems like maybe he's just being nice to Edith there. Cause as soon as she's out of the picture, he's like, okay, that's enough of this.
Yeah. It may not be entirely obvious to the Doctor that mead is an alcoholic drink, right? It's entirely possible. That's the explanation, that he only realizes once he's sipping it. Oh, this isn't actually a non-alcoholic honey based beverage. mead's pretty damn strong. It's definitely brewed by monks, so it's the right thing for the location here. You're right. He does toss the second glass aside. So put this in the Doctor doesn't like alcohol category. You know, the way that he refuses it in the Gunfighters is definitely telling. And then, of course, we have the brandy and Twice Upon a Time to go against that. So you've got lots of evidence one way or the other. This is definitely the only time where he is clearly in the classic series, the first Doctor taking a drink. And it's not entirely clear whether he knows he's doing it.
Right, whether it's willing or not. But anyway, that's the foundation. You can go either way with the teetotal or the not teetotal direction. I kind of prefer my doctor as occasionally enjoys a drink, but I definitely understand depending on your kid appeal taste.
Yeah.
It can go either way. So when I still support him ordering a lemonade with lots of ice.
or milk, because he drinks in the Gunfighters. Yeah, so what did you detect a frisson between the Doctor and Edith? He seemed into her. He was very complimentary towards her.
You know, the Doctor's interesting because he's so flirty, particularly the first Doctor, with people in the past, and you feel like these sirens from from previous eras are really taken with the Doctor because he kind of speaks their language. He can kind of relate to them on a certain level, but he's clearly very wise beyond his years. And there's this sort of reverence and I would say attraction from these women to this very knowledgeable dude who seems, you know, very at ease with himself, but also able to sort of communicate them in a way that's sort of sensitive to where they, what they want to hear. So I can definitely see it. And I think they kind of lean into it a little bit. I mean, the way she, the actress looks at him, and he gets sort of persuasive with her later about, you know, the Viking invasion, really kind of wins her over much more than the monk does.
Yeah. She's very suspicious of him at first and basically kind of pins him to the wall with a pointy stick. When she first meets him, which I think, you know, as far as the doctor's concerned, that's a meet cute. he likes his feisty ladies to do that, but perhaps he also looked at Edith and thought, you know, that woman reminds me of a cave woman that I visited with Ian and Barbara and Susan one time, only cleaned up much nicer.
Is it the same actress?
It is the same actress. Yes. Who played in An Unearthly Child.
Alethea Charlton, I guess.
Yes, that's right.
Good for her.
So yeah, she gets to play this with her own hair.
No one does primitive like Alethea Charlton.
Well, she also unfortunately has to be, we have to discuss the question that comes up with Edith's character of was, you know, we know the Vikings like to rape and pillage, and they certainly pillaged the village.
Right.
And the indication is that they also raped Edith, which is a bit adult for a 1965 kids show to kind of give that. But I guess it's sort of ambiguous enough.
I think it's definitely ambiguous enough. So you can believe it if you want to. It's kind of like they did they or didn't they type scenes as well. Of like, did characters sleep with each other or was it just something more mild? I think, you know, depending on your lens here, 100% you could take that away. And I think that's kind of, if they weren't going for it, I think they should surely sort of saw it at some point and left it in. But it was, I mean, like, I watched this with my kids. Like I said, I didn't think of anything too, like it was too scandalous. Right. They didn't ask. I don't think, not that they didn't want to. I think it really genuinely didn't occur to them, because at first you're not sure if she's dead or not, right? Her eyes are just open. She's very still. You're kind of wondering, is she just supposed to be dead? And then you see her moving in the next scene and it's like, oh, okay, I guess she's not dead. And you can easily sort of chalk that up to being traumatized and no character. There's no other sort of telling reaction from someone else about what's happened here. But again, you know, it's 11th century, you know, it's a brutal attack. They're Vikings. I mean, I think.
Yeah. What did Vikings do? I mean, well, we know, by the way, what Vikings didn't do. They didn't wear horned helmets. So that was
a space helmet for a cow.
Exactly. That famous line that gave rise to a book on the history of Doctor Who, Space Helmet for a Cow, is from this episode, is from the Doctor sort of trying to impart upon Stephen that clearly they have time travel. But yeah, no, that wasn't a Viking helmet, Doctor. So it actually is a point in Stephen's favor that they haven't traveled to the 11th century.
Well, I got to say, that's definitely one of the better lines. I mean, it's very memorable. Yeah, and Hartnell, I mean, he gets credit in a lot of episodes for being, you know, his comedic chops. I think they're on full display here. He is great. Like, especially his stuff earlier, even in the TARDIS, where Stephen's being very much the skeptic. By the way, really smart writing there. I think they really took advantage of the anachronisms of the monk, Stephen's skepticism, and sort of playing those two things together to both frustrate the viewer and intrigue you, right? Like, well, wait a minute, what, we know that, like, as a viewer, you know the TARDIS is a time-traveling machine. Why is there a watch? Why is there a record? Why, et cetera, et cetera. So they play that up. But it's really funny where he's just like, you know, that's the dimensional control. There's a chair with a panda on it. Sheer poetry, my boy. I mean, it's just a classic.
Sheer poetry.
Classic bit.
The panda in the chair. Was the panda, did Stephen have a panda in the chase?
The backstory on Stephen in the chase was that he was from the future, and because he had been on Mechanus as a prisoner of the Mechanoids for so long, he had essentially developed a little bit of Wilson syndrome with his stuffed animal, his little panda, which he called Hi-Fi. So he really grew attached to it, saw it as another person or a being, I guess, and actually sort of there's a plot point around it that I won't get into. But that was the thing. Of course, that's quickly forgotten about, along with Stephen's beard here in in the first episode. Like, this is the last we see of or hear about Hi-Fi, I believe.
Hi-Fi.
Because, you know, he's got new friends.
I guess he just likes to hang out on chairs in the TARDIS, and that's sheer poetry.
I mean, maybe he took him with him in his last episode. I never saw Steven's last episode because we never see Hi-Fi again, and there's never been, like, it lying on a chair somewhere deep in the TARDIS. So maybe that was a thing.
Bring Hi-Fi back to the RTD caller. It's interesting.
Can you imagine cosplaying as Hi-Fi?
That'd be quite an easy cosplay thing. Just get your furry costume. So you also in that scene, you get Vicky outlining what TARDIS stands for only the second time in the show. After Susan did it in the Nursing Child, she changes the dimensions of your real stick up for words and exactly what D stands for. And Steve says it'd be IDDI. And Vicky says, what, IDDI? And Steve says, yeah, it means I don't believe it.
Right. Good line.
Good line. But also, like, why would could you not maybe choose a would it be a B O T I a body on the inside rather than artist? Or do you prefer a L O T O larger on the outside, a lotto, which is Clara called it. Anyway, that's the only time.
I think you're figuring out why they didn't go in this direction as you're talking it out.
Yeah. But even IDDI, maybe the best choice of alternate acronym, but good for you, Tim, for even trying.
Yeah. Well, I think, like, again, I think the first two episodes, I mean, throughout even, but like there's a bunch of good comedy in the first episode, the second episode, but I mean, what I really like about early on in this story is when Steven and Vicky are kind of on their own, separate from the doctor, they get a chance to sort of gel. And through Steven's skepticism and through some of the sort of stuff that happens, you kind of learn a little bit about Steven, at least. I don't think this is a particularly great episode for Vicky, but I do think Maureen O'Brien is good in it. Mm. And particularly in sort of giving her sort of wide-eyed, thinking out loud about changing time, but also playing off Steven earlier, like that whole stuff where he's like, I've got breakfast, it's blackberries and some blackberries. I mean, there's some good banter between of them, but I do also like the bit where Steven sees the guy sort of picking up the watch, and we don't know it's a watch yet, and Steven just sort of runs up and beats on him. and Vicky's just like, what are you doing? Like, but I do like what that sort of says about Steven, because, you know, with Ian out of the picture, obviously we need another, you know, dashing young man to be the action person. But he's different, right? Like, he's got a different personality. He's a little more wry. He's a little more skeptical. And he's a little more quick to sort of jump in on situations like this. So I really like that they're sort of consistent with the structure of the show here, but they're also showing us sort of starting to unpeel what layers there are to Steven Taylor and the kind of guy he is, while also, you know, giving him good interactions with Maureen O'Brien.
Yeah, he's definitely doing the Taylor name proud. So my favorite line from Steven is where he says, in response to the Saxon villager who says, I do not trust them, he says, well, I'm not mad about you either. Which seems, that seems like something that's sort of more amusing than the way Ian might have put it. He might be a bit too straight-laced about these things.
Yeah, exactly. He's a little more rat-a-tat. He's a little more shooting from the hip. I got to say, though, that scene sort of annoyed me on one level, because there's a point where they're like, well, let's see if we can get out of here. And Steven just stands up. Mm. Like, he just stands up, and then they turn to him and they have their spears out, and he goes, okay, I'm going to sit back down. Like, he doesn't even say anything. Yeah. He doesn't even say, like, by the way, we're travelers and we kind of like to go. Can we go? Like, you know, I guess maybe cool. The implication is he's going to, like, resort to some fisticuffs or something, and they can't. But I don't know. That just seems, again, he's quick to do that kind of thing, right?
By the way, also accurate, I love that they gather blackberries for breakfast, because that is literally what I've been doing here in ye olde Northumbria for most of the time I've been here. There are just blackberries everywhere right now. You can have them for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They are amazing, so much better than store-bought. So highly recommend it for that reason as well.
Well, I'm sure there were blackberries all over Northumbria about a decade ago as well, but of a different nature. Because that was a very popular phone in the UK, as I understand it.
Oh, yes, it was. Yeah. Back in the day.
Sorry, forgive the dad joke, everyone. It's just by BlackBerry on my mind, because there is an epic movie, Canadian movie, about the rise and fall of BlackBerry.
I love that movie.
It's actually quite good. I just saw it on a plane. It was amazing.
I saw that in theaters. I was so excited to see it. So, yeah, a starring role for Steve Jobs as well, as the ruiner of BlackBerry's dreams. so, yeah, fantastic. Both kinds of BlackBerries, fantastic here. It would have been great if the monk had a BlackBerry on his hip. Like just
right. So that's it, kind of brings up the funny thing of like he has all this 1960s technology, and in case of the phonograph, it's even earlier than that. Like he just, for whatever reason, he really digs the 20th century.
So he has a gramophone. Yeah. It was actually a tape recorder in the original script, but I guess they decided it looked better on screen as a gramophone, which makes more sense because a gramophone you can wind up, you don't actually need electricity to plug in, which is, I guess, you know, one limiting factor of the monk's technology is he can't, you know, he can't plug anything in 1066. There's no.
Well, I got the impression that the cable coming out of his TARDIS was doing that, because he has a toaster, right? Like the toaster has to be, and he's got a little camp stove, which I guess you could just do kerosene or something, but then where do you get the kerosene? So you'd have to bring some with you.
It's solar powered. He's solar powered. He has a little solar panel just off to one side of the monastery.
Well, that's a little advanced for 1960s, you know, but I guess he could just pop forward in time.
It's interesting.
Kind of like the Doctor. I mean, this is the thing about Time Lord. You have to sort of headcanon these anachronisms. And I really latch onto that bit in The Deadly Assassin that the Time Lords no longer worship technology. And so since they have all of time and space to choose from, it's really more of a style preference.
Yeah.
And you just kind of, you know, it's just kind of amusing to them to use technology.
A gramophone would definitely be the steampunk option. That seems to be, you know, the steampunk option seems to be what the Doctor's going for of late in her later incarnations. But yeah, it's interesting choices here. They name check penicillin, and the monk says, it's a sort of herb. I don't know why he just doesn't say it's a sort of fungus. It's literally what it is. or blood transfusion. You know, he's like, I could give her a blood transfusion. Name check modern technology moment. But yeah, you
is
almost want
to. Penicillin the thing you give some, I guess, to prevent infection, theoretically. Yeah. So that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
It's not as common today, too.
Yeah, he's a bit
swallow some penicillin when you've been chopped up by a broadsword.
Yeah, that'll grow that limb right back. Don't you worry. The Vikings in this, we have to say, to go back to them. The first thing, I was actually watching this with my mother. First thing she noticed was the terrible Viking wigs.
And the terrible Viking names and the terrible Viking non-accents and
they're kind of as hapless as the monk is himself. They kind of make good comedy villain bedfellows there.
Well, what do you mean hapless as the monk? Because that's a good thing we haven't really talked too much about Peter Butterworth and his performance as the monk. Now, he's more of a comedic actor, and he's played more comedically here, which I think works pretty well. But there's a little, certainly a tinge, and this is probably why you might think he's the master. There's a tinge of evil in his plan.
Yeah.
Because he's very casually going to slaughter a whole bunch of Vikings, which admittedly are coming to invade. There's going to be mass slaughter kind of regardless. But again, that's kind of like the warlord's argument in the war games. These people would have died anyway. Not really a good argument. Still kind of an act of evil. I don't know. What do you think of both the performance and his motivation?
I thought the performance was great. Peter Butterworth was later known for his role in the Carry On comedy films. And he definitely shows his comedy chops here. He's got that kind of gurning look on his face a lot. The idea of the monk, I don't know. I mean, it's first of all, I now know that the bay, King Edward's Bay, just off Tynemouth Priory, is so treacherous that these monks writing in earlier centuries that were kind of banished here noted that ships were just founder anyway. So maybe you didn't even need the atomic explosion. But secondly, if you throw an atomic bomb at a Viking fleet, that's going to have more repercussions than just destroying the fleet, right?
It's a tactical nuke. It's okay.
A bit of a tsunami, maybe, washing the Saxons out to sea. Maybe they will start worshipping the monk. That would be one way for this to go belly up as a plan.
It's definitely not Time Lord style, yeah. I'll say. If it's, again, I think they just kind of leaned too far into modern technology and decided they had to call it an atomic cannon.
Yeah.
The
best way to see the monk, I think, is, you know, is as an avatar of Dennis Spooner. The writer of this was also the script editor. And this is the first pseudo-historical. So he's deliberately going against the grain of the historical story by introducing the element of the monk. So you can sort of see the monk as an avatar for Spooner himself, saying, no, you should be able to change time in Doctor Who. So he's the anti not one line guy who's coming in and bringing this new flavor of time travel to Doctor Who. So maybe the monk isn't the best thought out character, but it's his way of saying, hey, you know, I'm taking the show that was put together on the back of a napkin, and I'm going to create a character that's the opposite of the Doctor, basically, who thinks that he can meddle in time. And he even used the original show Bible from 1963, the one that Sidney Newman had when he founded the show, of like, here's what Doctor Who is. And I love this when creators do this. They're just like, well, I'm going to create a character that's everything the Doctor isn't. Which is sort of how The Master began as well, right? Moriarty to the Doctor's Holmes. But a little bit cheekier and a little bit more direct of a way to sort of set out your stall and say, I'm going to change what the show is about. So, you know, it's kind of basic as a story. It's kind of basic as a character. But it's definitely a way of nudging the show in a new direction.
And I think if you were writing it today, you might plan a little more certainly than they did here, and you might even take the monk with on an arc and essentially turn him into the master after a few more encounters maybe with the Doctor, right? So you sort of see a darkening of it. I haven't seen the Daleks master plan. I kind of know sort of what happened, so I do feel like that started the direction they started to go in with the monk. So again, I see the appeal of like thinking they're the same character. But I also sort of prefer them not to be, just because, you know, obviously we've gotten much more backstory in the Master and his history with the Doctor. So it's just not really compatible with the monk. But I like the monk as more of a mischievous force that you don't like an ideological opposite to the Doctor doesn't necessarily need to be like a super dark mirror, that this guy's just, you know, he's mischievous. He just wants to do stuff. He talks about like, oh, you know, this is fun. And like his whole like mopiness when the Doctor's going to screw up his fun. I mean, that's really good. And you can definitely see Spooner's evolution here, because he wrote two historicals prior to this. He wrote The Reign of Terror and The Romans.
And
with the Romans, he's already messing with the formula a bit, right?
Yes.
Like he's separating everyone. It's made more of a comedy. There's more slapstick stuff. Nero is almost like the monk in a sense. Sort of almost this character outside of history in there that is he's using as kind of a foil for the Doctor and to sort of get things going. So, yeah. And then here he just sort of goes all the way with it, with this pseudo-historical, which would then become more of a template.
Right, exactly.
Back in history.
Exactly. And you know, some fans have argued that this is the turning point for the show, that basically the historical was pretty much dead after this. I mean, it did sort of limp on, and there were a few more, and officially the Highlanders is the last, or Was it
Black Orchid?
Black Orchid, yes. Which where yeah, I mean, you know, the pseudo historical was of which this is the first was the new template for how you go back in time. You just add a little science fiction element or a little time travel element. But it's interesting, as basic as it seems to us, it was very confusing for viewers at the time. Because I was reading up on these audience research reports where they go and ask the audience what they think of this. And there were comments like of, I don't get it. I don't understand. Why is there a wristwatch? Why is there a gramophone? So, you know, we may sort of criticize it for like not taking it to extremes, but like this was as far as the audience of 1965 was prepared to go. And maybe it was even too far for them.
Yeah, maybe. I think Steven does a lot to sort of ease that transition because he's sort of, he's partially like the audience in terms of his skepticism. But like I said earlier, the audience also knows better than Steven. We know this is a time travel show and that it's supposed to be. So while it's confusing, I think it's to the credit, maybe it's because they were sort of between producers, but so it might've been serendipitous. But that no one sort of stepped in and decided to sort of dumb things down or spell things out anymore and just wait for it all to come together.
Except for William Hartnell. Episodes 3 and 4. who decided and apparently expected that they should be grateful for him stepping in to sort of say this aside to the audience of like how stuff went down in 1066.
Oh, very, okay.
Very
sounds
strange.
Like a Hartnell move.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, sounds like he answered some questions on the minds of viewers, but
indeed.
Now we need to answer some other questions. And those are, of course, the 4 questions to Doomsday. First question, why did the randomizer take us here?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it's just so, so strange that this ticks so many boxes, not just knowing Chris was going to be in the northeast of England and serving in one of the few other northeastern stories. We may even have a northeastern England bingo. I don't even know. I think we probably do. Be interesting to see if we can find another one. I'll have to come back next year and challenge the randomizer to find one for me. But also the Time Lord connection, you know, the Gallifrey connection. Yep. We found that Full Circle was a Gallifrey story. We didn't expect that.
A little bit.
You know, go back and listen to that episode if you want to find out why. You know, and this is low-key a Gallifrey story as well. And, you know, big TARDIS story. And we know the randomizer loves those. So, yeah, definitely continuing on from its recent obsession with Time Lords and Gallifrey.
So I think you're right. And here's my more direct theory from a direct through line from Full Circle. This might be the one episode that supports Romana's stated weight of the TARDIS. Because she says it's like this ungodly weight, right? It's like, so whatever. So she needs scientific notation to describe it. It's tons and tons and tons and tons.
50,000 tons.
And so
like
it lands on the beach and it's still there when the tide comes back. So, but like what we've seen of the TARDIS in other stories, that still doesn't make physical sense, right? Because the TARDIS can be moved by physical force. People can actually put their hands on it, put it on a wagon or something, and take it somewhere.
That's
seen
right.
It happen a lot of times. So
we
why
saw it in Full
water,
Circle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why couldn't water do that? Well, here's why. It's too damn heavy. It's just sitting there on the beach, and it's just it won't be washed out. It might as well be like, you know, mounted in the ground. So boom, there
and
it is.
It's lucky that there were no marsh creatures. It's also lucky that the Doctor didn't have the flotation setting for the TARDIS that we saw in I always think of it as the Weed
the
of Death
of
now.
See that? No, no way. No, Seeds of Death.
No.
The Fury.
Yes, Fury from the Deep.
Fury from the Deep.
We got there in the end. Yes, go back and listen to our Fury from the Deep episode for lots of discussion on the floaty TARDIS.
The TARDIS and water, it's just a grab bag. Who knows? Kind of depends on whether it's salt water, fresh water, beach, not beach. under, you know, there's sea devils involved.
Yeah.
Could be all the way down with an air bubble. Who knows?
Right. Right. Has the doctor trying to land it underwater and open the doors like it did in Legopolis? And the TARDIS says no to that. Yeah. Yeah. The TARDIS really has its own, you know, maybe this is all to do with the swimming pool.
Oh yeah, it's like, preserve the swimming pool.
If the swimming pool's inside, then it floats, or I don't know, someone way more nerdy than I needs to do a look at every single time the TARDIS encounters water and whether the swimming pool was there or not.
Good project, let us know, folks. But in the meantime, we're moving on to the second question, which is, what if the evil plot had succeeded?
Alrighty, I have been waiting for this moment because,
because we get to enter alternate history corner.
Alternate history corner, which I like even better than history corner. And let me tell you something, the monk is just flat out wrong.
Ooh.
If there've been lots of counterfactuals written on this subject because it's such an important pivotal moment in British history. Basically, what happened when William the Conqueror wins, when he becomes the Conqueror, he basically has this whole kingdom that he effectively unites. It was a bunch of sort of fractured kingdoms, including Northumbria. I would be remiss in not mentioning that the north part of Northumbria was called Benicia, because my late father was a big fan of the Benicia studies group that he was involved in. Anyway, big shout out to the Benicia fans out there. But basically, that's the future that England was looking at under King Harold. It was a lot of sort of fractured relationships with these kingdoms within England, which were already in revolt. He's got to face the Vikings. Whereas when the Conqueror comes in, he unites the kingdom. He does the Doomsday Book, which you may have heard of. Which is basically a list of literally everything in the kingdom so he can tax it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Doctor
Who fans. I like their spreadsheets.
Exactly. It is William the Conqueror's spreadsheet. And it allowed England to become a peaceful country. The monk is wrong in terms of talking about, you know, focusing on all the French wars that would happen because William supposedly got us involved in fighting in the continent, and that led to the Hundred Years' War and all these other wars, and that held back development of, you know, technology in England, and maybe we would have had the Industrial Revolution earlier. No, nonsense. The standard opinion upon historians of the era is that if Harold had won, England would just sort of continue to kind of be just this outpost, not connected to Europe, not really trading with Europe, just kind of a little country, more of a Scandinavian country than anything else, because of all of the Viking connections and the connections of the Norwegian king, who was the one trying to invade, trying to claim his kingdom back.
So wait a minute, is there then a British Empire? Does it seem less likely? Does it become part of the Viking Empire?
Yeah, exactly. It seems less likely, and the continent would go a different way, and England would just be sort of this, outcropping on the edge of Europe, basically a very, very early pre-Brexit, if you will.
Wow.
Just becomes less relevant.
So then there's less things they're doing. There's probably no BBC and, of course, no Doctor Who. Oh my God, this is all a plot to get rid of the Doctor in a more creative way. It looks like
possibly a plot to get rid of the United States of America, which wouldn't have happened in the same way without its English colonists. It's very
interesting.
Very interesting. Definitely wouldn't have turned out the way the monk wanted.
It's either depowered England in your version, or in the monk's fantasy world, it's super powerful, technologically advanced England. And just to entertain for a bit, as fictional as it probably is, like, that's kind of where I went in thinking about, like, what would that be? So, like, it feels like to me, in that version of events, this is a path to what you might think of, like, as pure monarchy Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, we come to a technologically advanced time, and certainly if the monk's schedule is right, that Shakespeare's on television, then by the 20th century, we're super advanced and we have colonies. But possibly politically, we haven't really moved past a monarchy. So it might even explain or provide a path for all these planets we see all throughout Doctor Who that are advanced. Like Peladon is a good example, but they have monarchies. They're ruled by a king or a queen.
Interesting.
And it's interesting to think about, like, what is the path Earth could have gone down to see that technology advanced quicker, but our political systems didn't.
Interesting. Yeah, that's definitely one possible outcome. It just, you know, to go back to this point, not to labor it, but it beggars belief that the monk would have just chosen King Harold as his basically his chosen king, that he's going to like manipulate. He's going to, I guess, give him a bunch of technology. But why Harold? Why not William? William would be a much better, a mark for this scheme. Because first of all, you could just present him with the Doomsday Book before it's written. It's like, you're over here, and you want a list of every structure in the kingdom so you could tax it all. Oh, here's one I did earlier. You know, so impressing the king that, like, not only do you save 2 years on writing the Doomsday Book, you know, you've got him in your thrall, and then you're like, hey, you know, I got
the head of your IRS.
Exactly. very powerful position. You know, so yeah, very, very
maybe
strange.
That begets all the Robin Hood stuff.
Yes.
We see later, right? Amongst the sheriff?
Well, certainly one thing we can say for sure is that the master's evil plan in King's Demons would not have had the opportunity to come to light. There would probably be no Magna Carta, no King John, without William the Conqueror.
Potentially a master monk showdown. I'm sure that's been written somewhere, but we need to do some rewriting of our own, which leads us to the third question, which of course is, where is the Clara Splinter? All right, Clara Oswald. As everyone knows, splintered in time at the end of The Name of the Doctor. She is somewhere in every single Doctor Who story. What is she doing in the Time Meddler?
We've mentioned St. Oswin.
Yeah, it's true.
The bones of St. Oswin, mysteriously found at Tynemouth Priory in 1065. So maybe that is a sign that she was there making sure that this is an area of interest for people to come back to. Because we do know that the priory was ruined before that. And why did the monk come along and choose it? Well, maybe Clara was lighting the way for him. So she guide him in then, and his appearance guides the TARDIS to come and take the Doctor where he needed to go.
Interesting. Yeah, I definitely had Clara not necessarily in the episode, because I don't think there's too much to clear up in terms of direct plot holes. Maybe a little bit at the monastery when all the villagers rush in, and it's really just a comedy scene of them rushing in and out and the monk evading them. Which is a bit silly, and you can sort of make up reasons why Clara sort of maneuvered things in certain ways so that the monk can escape. That's a little easy. I was thinking similarly that something cleared out that monastery, right? Something happened to make it abandoned. And there is a village there, and so maybe Clara was part of a previous generation in the villagers that perhaps something scandalous happened with the monks there. I'm not going to fill in any blanks, but not sure. Something could have happened, and then maybe they were essentially all run out of town, and then it was just easy pickings for the monk to come in, appropriate it, and maybe there's a certain amount of acoustic quality, shall we say,
that
monastery.
Yeah, she's setting up all of the amplifiers, because just a gramophone by itself is not going to, you know.
Or just, making sure the, you know, sound, as long as you have the right size tubes, right size holes in the walls, it'll amplify it. So that's all you really need to do.
Maybe, you know what, I'm also thinking, we haven't mentioned this, but the monk mentions that he helped Stonehenge get built. using anti-gravity or gravity lift for the stones or something like that. Now, someone needs to keep the monk from discovering that that Stonehenge is actually where the Pandorica is. Is that correct?
Oh, that is correct.
So,
yeah,
the monk needs to not do too much digging in ancient Britain during his Stonehenge visit. Which, by the way, was that time meddling? Did he rewrite the history books? Who even knows? Was he successful?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it was what I like about how they leave it. It's a bit ambiguous, but the strong suggestion is that what we know as history is already the monk's altered history. Mm. Like the stuff with the Leonardo da Vinci and Stonehenge just existing. Mm. So all that makes sense. I mean, there must have been some digging with Stonehenge. Like, you know, they must have done it in such a way that you simply couldn't tell that it was done with an anti-gravity lift. But you know, I've seen that conspiracy theory tossed out in various books when I was a kid. It's funny to think about and, you know, fun to throw into our script of Doctor Who.
Yes.
It'd be funny if he left a note for the 11th Doctor to find before his big, here's your speech.
Exactly.
You know, he had it pre-written for him.
And, you know, maybe if she was in charge of the acoustics at the monastery in 1066, maybe she can also be in charge of the acoustics at Stonehenge so that the Doctor's bullhorn can basically get more of a sound boost so all these spaceships can hear it.
Oh, you know what? This is awakening something. Maybe she was the companion of the monk.
Mm.
For a few adventures, and this is why the reason he was caught, because now he doesn't have companions anymore. Maybe he left her at Stonehenge for whatever reason.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. That makes
sense. Could be a whole Monk Clara Big Finish series. That
well, you know, I think there is. So Rufus Hound, a British comedian, has played the monk in Big Finish, and there is a one where he meets up with Missy. So there is that. Monk master connection. I think it's in the whatever the Big Finish is with all the masters in it. They throw the monk in as well. So we got to put that in our must listen Big Finishes.
The masters.
Okay.
Yes. I don't know if that's it. I think it's like masterful. Good stuff. Okay, Clara, you're nominated for another companion gig. Hope you take it. All right, moving on to the last question. The only question that matters for the Time Meddler. What did we think of this story? The Volta Open rating system has 6 ratings. The first, the Dalek, is what we give to a good episode of Doctor Who. There is also the Ogron, which we give to a bad episode of Doctor Who. And the other ratings are not worth mentioning. No, it's there's 4 others. There's actually the Professor Hayter, not so great episode that at least tried something, or at least we learned something. The Viscount Banger, which you reserve for the best of the best of the best, and they are vested. And the Fixed Point in Time, which is what we give to a story that is beyond rating that we usually can't rate for reasons of nostalgia, but sometimes for other reasons. Oh, and yes, of course, there is also the Lady Cassandra, for those still awake. It is a rating that we give to Doctor Who as wallpaper, that this story isn't that great, but hey, it looks good. So you might want to turn it on in the background for a party or whatever else you happen to be doing.
Yes. So I'm kind of torn on this one. I was, for a while, I was thinking, it's not a Viscount Banger. Despite the fact a lot of people consider this one of the best Hartnell stories, I don't think it's necessarily up there. I don't think it's a Viscount Banger. Not even sure it's
Before you finish that thought, I'm just going to throw in my ratings here from the most recent Doctor Who magazine. It speaks to exactly what you just talked about, because it has risen in the rankings consistently since 1998. Because back in 1998, among all the Hartnell stories, of which there are 29, it was ranked 12th. But it is every poll since, it's risen to 8 to 5. And now in 2023, to second place.
Yeah.
The second most popular Hartnell story right after the Dalek invasion of Earth.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure that it necessarily deserves that reputation. What have they got right below it?
The Daleks' master plan.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. I mean, we'll have to watch more Hartnell to figure out whether it's up there. But that's an interesting choice. For me, I was thinking Professor Hayter because they were trying something new, but I'm not sure I can necessarily recommend it. But now I wonder if it's a fixed point in time, ironically. If we don't want to meddle in the rankings of this, because it was just, it's just sort of like, it's just the first pseudo historical and it was just, everything was new and you can't really rank it. I'm not sure. What are your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are that it is a very nice Dalek. I did like the episode. It holds up. I enjoyed watching it. I enjoyed watching it in particular with my kids who hadn't seen it before. I liked seeing their reactions to things, and they both really liked it too. They didn't love it, but Grace, I liked that she didn't just like the monk and the big reveal, but also that she talked about how Steven and Vicky were on their own for a while and had to figure out things for themselves. Like, it is a smart choice to have them stumble upon the TARDIS. And, you know, because they're, in particular, Vicky, who's already used to this lifestyle, is sort of thrown through a loop by a number of things. First, the anachronisms, and then the TARDIS reveal. And so this is a very crazy story for her and Steven as well, obviously, is his first adventure. So it's really fun to follow them along. And they sort of paper over the Hartnell's absence in the second episode pretty well. I would say, I think, one of the things that is unfortunate that he's not there, a lot is relying on the villagers and their interactions with the monk and the Steven and Vicky. And I also think, first, there's too much of that. You kind of sort of lose track of who's going to where and why. But there's a bit there where they sort of try to outsmart the monk, but the monk really outsmarts them. And I don't think they really do enough with that. Like, I kind of wanted to see something a little more definitive of the monk sort of trapping them or turning the tables, or I don't know, it just seemed like now they need to be in the prison or now they need to escape. And now we're doing that rather than it sort of stemming naturally from the story. So for that reason, I think it's not quite a banger. I can't quite do it because it's, there are some weaknesses here, but it's definitely a very good Dalek. I'm into it.
Interesting. Yeah, I can't give it a Dalek. And you were actually bringing up something else, which is that whole thing where Steven thinks that he's tricked the monk into revealing that he has the doctor because the monk gives away more details of the doctor's clothing.
That's what I was talking about.
Yeah. So, but there's no resolution to that. We don't find out if the monk is that smart. And it just sort of, it feels a bit haphazard. It feels a bit all over the place. All right, I'm calling it. It's a Professor Hayter for me. It's a very good Professor Hayter. It may be the best Hayter of the Hayters. It's definitely trying something new, but I'm sorry, it's dragged down by the Saxons. It's dragged down by the Vikings. It's dragged down by a script that's been sort of all over the place and kind of stretched a bit thin. The lack of music is a bit strange. Like, there's not a lot of music in this. But, you know, a hater isn't bad. We learn something. We learn the pseudo-historical nature of Doctor Who definitely works. It's a good template for stuff going forward. So I call it a hater without prejudice.
Oh, okay. Not even a wobbly Dalek?
maybe a hater-Dalek hybrid. You're kind of convincing me on the Dalek front, so maybe we can give
this.
Like,
so much fun to be had here. I mean, the comedy, the monk stuff totally works. The big reveal, I cannot for the life of me say this is not a good episode of Doctor Who. But some people might think it isn't. So, you know, don't.
Maybe I'm prejudiced by my mother's opinion on it, which is that basically that we were definitely not in the golden age of television in the mid-1960s.
So you're sticking with Hayter, or is it a hybrid?
Hybrid. Dalek, Hayter, hybrid. There. So it's 75% Dalek.
Hayter with a plunger. Got it. All right, folks, that closes the history and alternate history books on the Time Meddler, and we are going to go into our own full-size TARDIS and find out where we're going next.
All right, time to fire up the randomizer. The randomizer has two elements. Pete has one. It's the codex. It's the entire list of Doctor Who stories in sequential order. And they all have numbers next to them, and we have reduced the number to the low 200s. Pete, where are we exactly in our journey?
We are now at 208, now that I've just marked off the time meddler.
208. Not only are we close to being one third of the way through the codex, we are close to the magic 100 stories reviewed. That's going to be an exciting time when we do that. Stay tuned for more pull to open content around that. But I have plugged 1 and 208 into random.org, aka the executor. This is how we choose our next random story. We will give the randomizer some challenges, and then random.org will, using atmospheric noise, not algorithmic randomness, which computers use, which is kind of rubbish, not true randomness, but atoms bouncing around the atmosphere definitely counts as true randomness, true-ish, truer. And the randomizer has definitely been, appeared to be taking us on a journey, and appears to know where I'm going on vacation. So I'm not sure it's going to listen to our challenges, but Pete, what have you got for it?
This episode always gets me to think of breakfast. So I want something where the characters sit down for a meal and have, you know, they don't have to show the actual meal, but let's have that feature somewhere in the story. I'll even take a snack.
Well, we've already done the Romans, so we can't have Ian and his grapes. But there are many, many more feasts in the history of Doctor Who. I'm going to piggyback on that and get a little bit more specific, because in episode 2, when the Doctor is in prison the whole episode, there is some water thrown out of his cell and in the monk's face. And a lot of people have taken it to be that he's throwing hot tea in the monk's face. It is actually supposed to be some water that's just in the cell. Right. However, there is definitely tea in Doctor Who. So let's...
Yes. Many times tea is offered as well.
Tea is offered. Tea is a big plot point at the beginning of The Three Doctors, for example, where the Doctor
tea leaves feature prominently in The Time Monster.
Yeah. So many tea options. So here I am in the UK. It's rare that we do this transatlantic version of Pull to Open, so I feel I'd be remiss if I did not ask for a cup of tea.
It's the eat and drink challenge for the randomizer this time on Pull to Open. All righty. Well, we got it. We got our challenges. Here is the countdown coming at you at 4, 3, 2, 1.
Unstable.
5.
No.
Yes, we're still in
Never.
Hartnell. It is number 5.
Oh, I should have seen this coming. It is the Aztecs.
Wow. Oh my God.
It is. I mean, the connection's right there. I mean, we just talked about it.
Folks, I know you're gonna be listening to this and you're not going to believe it. So I'm going to do a screenshot right now of the exact time that I hit the generate button just to prove that this was not planned in advance. This is not fake. This is not a lie. We have not rewritten history. You cannot rewrite the history of Pull to Open. Not one line. We have been sent to the opposite of the Time Meddler. We have been sent to the Aztecs. Wow.
That's true. It's the changing time opposite. That's incredible. I mean, you know, it's cliche now, but we're scared of the randomizer. I mean, it's constantly listening. And it knows where we need to go. Okay.
Oh my goodness.
The Aztecs. More Hartnell. More time travel. More history. More potential changing of that history.
Indeed. Wow. The original TARDIS team. And I guess, there's probably some feasting in there. Probably not a lot of tea.
Yeah, no tea.
But Barbara's a god, so they're going to have feasts in her honor. Yeah.
Some food's involved.
Yeah.
All right, folks, you go ahead and get some food involved, too. Have a snack. Go get some dinner before you binge the next episode or the Pull to Open, or wait for it, depending on when you're listening to this. Guys, this has been Pull to Open, the podcast. It's a podcast. Go ahead, subscribe to it. Whatever platform you're on, there's probably a follow button if you haven't done that. Please tap that button. If you're on YouTube, there's a like button. There's a notifications button besides the subscribe button. Those are both good things to tap. Once again, reviews are a great way to support the podcast. Go ahead, leave them in whatever app you're listening to us on. Star ratings are almost as good. In fact, maybe even better. So if you're on Spotify, you can leave one of those. And reminder, if you are on Spotify, you can also rate the story that we just rated. You didn't like that we called it a Dalek, you think it's a Viscount banger like many of the people who wrote into Doctor Who magazine, you go ahead, let us know and let the other fans know by voting on Spotify what you think the proper rating is for the Time Meddler. Follow us on the socials at Pull2Open63 on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, missing one, Facebook, and Pull2Open, all one word, on TikTok. Okay, we will you next time.
We'll see you in Mexico.
The Aztecs. You betcha.
Looking forward to it.
Watch out for those eclipses. I hear they can be lethal.